I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Miranda Nelson joins me now. She is assistant editor for Strait.com, the website for the Georgia Strait. She's been with the Strait since 2008 and joins me now to look at current events in late June 2015, just before summer, and before what promises to be a hectic fall, what with the federal election in the offing. I've invited Ms. Nelson on the program now. As if you've followed the media in Vancouver, she's ubiquitous on social media, Twitter especially. She's been on the receiving end of a lot of vitriol online, and I wanted to explore why she's getting it and the sorts of conversations that happen online that deteriorate into name-calling, threats, and outright abuse. I'll ask her about Gamergate, feminism, current events, as well as public transit, and more. Her own blog can be found at farmhousepress.wordpress.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program and studio, as it were, Miranda Nelson. Ms. Nelson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is good use of my Saturday.
Well, I do feel bad that you have to come in on your weekend, especially since it's gorgeous out.
Oh, whatever. Gives me an excuse to get out of the house.
And you live not too far from where I am.
Yeah, just up the street.
Yeah. One of the reasons, first of all, I've got to ask you that obligatory question about what's happening at your paper, especially in light of the Furlong case against Laura Robinson. And I don't expect you to tell us very much, but I guess the only question I have is, how has this Furlong specter, how has that affected, say, the day-to-day at the paper since 2012 when the piece by Robinson was published?
Well, I can't really speak too much to that. Honestly, our day-to-day lately hasn't been affected that much at all. Charlie, he testified on Friday. I think that went really well. I wasn't there in the courtroom, but I heard sort of the banter on social media about it. So I'm just glad that Laura's getting her day.
It's been an interesting case, hasn't it? I mean, it fascinates people on Twitter.
It does, and I think any time anybody in a position of power has any sort of allegation come out like that, there is an interesting way that the media reacts to it in the chatter, and Charlie said in his testimony that it maybe have been a little bit of public relations. So I sort of think about how that applies to other scandals these days. Somebody pointed out on social media, actually, the other day, Jean Gomeshi sort of tried to launch a public relations battle, but his PR firm dropped him. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and any time that the media is in the spotlight, I guess that's interesting for everyone, isn't it?
It is, and it's kind of hard when you're kind of the story to keep your distance from it. I think we've done a good job, though.
Yeah. In terms of why you're here. Because I've followed you on Twitter for a while now, and I've noticed the anger and the vitriol, as I said in the introduction, that you've been getting online.
Yes.
Someone asked me the other day what Gamergate is, and I said it's a hashtag, because I didn't really know what it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, is that the source, I guess, of all the negativity that you've been getting on the internet?
Well, Gamergate is a little bit of it. I mean, I can explain what I see Gamergate as,
sure,
which many people will probably disagree with, as
it's about
they do.
It's been about a year, right?
It started in August. An angry man put up a very angry post about his ex-girlfriend, alleging all sorts of behavior. And if you read sort of how he rolled this out, his intention was to hurt this person. And then Adam Baldwin, who was on Firefly, who's sort of a notorious conservative and Twitter instigator, maybe is the way to put it. He coined the term Gamergate because it had just sort of, this attack on this one woman sort of started talking about the idea of ethics in gaming journalism, which obviously there's been a lot of problems, like companies paying for sponsorship, the fact that you pay your all of the reviewers, game reviewers, to come to one space to review games. And like, those reviews can make or break a company, basically. And I understand, like, that's hard in an industry when everybody knows each other. Like, there's going to be issues of impropriety. But, I mean, that's the same of every journalism game, right? Like, I'd assume that's the same in car journalism, in travel journalism, and in whatever kind.
Politics.
Yeah, it's a small playing field, and everybody knows each other. But to point, anyway, that's separate from Gamergate. Yeah. I understand that, like, obviously some things need to change in the gaming industry, but Lee Alexander, I think it was, she wrote a piece about how, like, the identity of gamer was dead, and then that turned into this whole Gamergate thing. It's like, we're not dead, we're really attached to being computer gaming video game people, and it's just, that's your own whole identity. And I don't know, I've watched it in the last however many months, and it just feels like the same people who get angry about me posting something with a Gamergate hashtag are the same people who get mad at me when I talk about men's rights being ridiculous. Yeah. Like, I feel there is some legitimate anger in a group that sort of sees themselves as the underdog, and then a bunch of conservative, anti-woman jerkwads got a hold of it and just manipulated it. And so now every time you post anything about Gamergate, you are inundated with misogyny, racism, hate speech. Like, it's just bizarre. And, like, to the point where they had a conference, and I don't remember where it was. It was, like, last week. And they wanted to have a panel discussion about Gamergate, but they couldn't even use the hashtag, so they used the hashtag Death Eaters. Mm. So Gamergate wouldn't know that they were talking about them on Twitter. And then the last day of the conference, somebody messed up and used the Gamergate hashtag, and within 10 minutes, their Death Eater hashtag had been flooded by these same people. And I'm just... it just amounts to a lot of online yelling at each other at this point, really.
And so what's the worst that you've gotten in terms of the abuse? I mean, it has gotten pretty bad, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've had people threaten to rape me and kill me. That was probably sort of the worst of it.
Yeah.
But I have people calling me names pretty much daily. But it's funny, since August, like, there was sort of a rise, like, probably peak Gamergate was, like, maybe November, December.
Yeah.
Since then, like, I posted a few things on the Gamergate hashtag this morning. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
They're probably still asleep.
Probably.
Saturday.
Yeah, it's Saturday. They're probably asleep. But I find that the vitriol and nonsense is going down.
Yeah.
And this is, again, just my anecdotal experience.
Sure.
But I feel like people are just tired of the yelling and the screaming at each other.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not a video gamer, but this interested me because it sort of said something about where we are in the culture and in the discourse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has coarsened, hasn't it?
Pardon me?
The level of discussion and how we talk to each other on the internet, it has gotten pretty bad, hasn't it?
It has, and I feel like we've really... with the more people who come online, the more we're able to other people, because they're strangers. It's a faceless person that you're sniping at through a website who you're never going to meet. And, yeah, as more people have come onto the internet, it's become less civil. And there's that thing where you can fire off a comment and get an immediate response. And, like, that actually physically hits your dopamine receptors. Like, that feels good to get those fake little internet points and to have somebody respond to you. But they're still just words on a screen, right? Mm-hmm. You're not having that face-to-face dialogue. You don't know who this person is. And it's really easy to concoct an idea of somebody without meeting them and actually having that talk, right?
Think the worst.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And, like, I'm totally guilty of it with these Gamergate jerks, right? I call them Gamergate jerks. I throw everybody who's ever used that hashtag into the same dirty little bowl. And it's unfair of me. I know that. And I try to realize that I other people as much as I can. And I have attempted to have dialogue with some of these people who have legitimate questions. And more often than not, it devolves into them calling me a bitch, and I say, okay, you're blocked.
Yeah.
You know, like,
So where do you think this sets us in this, whether it's a trajectory or a decline of society? Because, I mean, the internet is so ubiquitous as it is. You know, I do worry about where we're headed.
I do, too, but the flip side of that is, we're talking about it, and we're exposing this sort of stuff. And I'm seeing a big shift, really. E3 came out this week, I think and the fact that you can have playable female protagonists in a video game, that's a shift. And maybe that's been in the works for 3 or 4, or however many years they've been developing that game, but that shows that there is a shift, you know? And when people say horrible, racist, sexist, gross things online, more often than not, people are going to say, that's not okay. You have Nobel Prize-winning scientist Tim Hunt saying, women are just too emotional to be in a laboratory, and women say, that's not okay to say anymore. And I think, I mean, I feel very bad for Tim Hunt. That sucks for him, but at a certain point, I don't think the culture is going to accept these old, outdated stereotypes about gender and language and race that we've always just sort of accepted.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like it's going to get bad and bad and bad, and then there's going to be a breaking point, and then things are going to get better. But maybe that's just the Pollyanna optimist in me.
Well, where does Charleston?
Where
does that sort of figure in this? I mean, is that a breaking point, do you think?
I hope so. President Obama has had to go 14 times and address the nation about mass violence. Like, this needs to stop. The fact that people are calling to have the Confederate flag taken down over the courthouse or the
Isn't it shocking at 2015 that the Confederate flag is still an issue? I mean, because I guess we live in Canada, we just assume that it wasn't, and for a lot of people in that state, it is their banner. It is their, you know, their standard.
It is, and it's really, really abhorrent to me. Like, why are we standing? Like you said, it's 2015. I still wonder why there's a big debate about which woman to put on a $10 bill. Like, that doesn't make sense. Why are we having these discussions? Why is playable female protagonist a big deal? Yeah. Like, why are we even having a conversation about the Confederate flag? Take it down. Respect the citizens of your country. Yeah. I'm sorry, white supremacy is over. It's just, the culture's changing. And, I don't know. It breaks my heart, though. Like, yeah.
Is being a feminist online, is that difficult? Is that hard?
It is, in a weird way. Like, it's funny, because I used to be one of those, I'm not a feminist. Feminists burn their bras, and they hate men, and I bought into those second wave stereotypes, and then I started listening to more feminists online, and just being like, no, you know what, this is something I need to fight for. Like, I made the shift in college where I kind of put away the second wave, like, stereotypes of it all. I'm like, no, let's women's equality is a good thing. Like, why am I scared to use this word? Mm-hmm. And, I started talking about feminism more and more online, and I got more and more vitriol back. And, I mean, I poke the bear sometimes. I'll say men's rights are nothing, but they kind of are. Because every men's rights activist I see out there is really about hating women, where I see the feminists out there caring about everybody, you know? Like, wanting to make safe space for women, men, transgender individuals, lesbians, gays. Like, I don't know. I feel like feminism is a good thing, and why would you ever not want to call yourself a feminist?
Yeah, it's weird because, you know, I grew up in I was born in 82, and so I grew up in the 90s, and so everything was politically correct.
Yep.
And I just assumed, again, in 2015, we wouldn't need to talk about this, but I guess we have to.
Yeah, and it's, again, when I was in college, I was born in 82 as well, like, I was having those conversations then, and I just like, why are we still having this conversation? Didn't we settle this all back in the day? Yeah. And why is it so scary to people to just be thoughtful about the language that you use and be thoughtful of how other people are going to respond to that? Like, you don't have an inalienable right to be bigoted. It seems so strange to me.
what do you think the Gomeshi case, what do you think that's added to, say, discussions that we're having, say?
I think between him and Cosby, this is going to sound so weird to say, the abuse of women has become something we talk about. That sounds so weird that this is like a trend in the media. Feminism is a trend in the media. Like, that's your go-to question now.
Yeah.
You ask women, so are you a feminist? Like, I'm glad this discourse is out there. I'm glad that we're holding people's feet to the fire. I'm really glad women are feeling like they can come forward and talk about the violence that's been perpetrated against them. And like, if you look back at the 60s, the idea of women coming together in a space and just talking to each other was a radical act. And I see us talking about these things on online spaces exactly parallel to that. This is a radical act. We're talking about just our own experiences and not shying away from them. Like, women talk about sexual assault, domestic violence, rape, abuse, and, like, we need to keep talking about this. And so while I am horrified that there are men out there abusing women, I am so, so proud that there are women who are willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
But you also see it with Emma Sulkowski. I'm going to get how to pronounce her name wrong. The girl who did the mattress protest at Columbia University, like, her entire story got picked apart. She mm-hmm. is victim blamed. No matter what she does, she's painted as a villain. And, like, that makes me sad. Why can't we just trust this woman and her story? Why do we have to pick it apart? There's no such thing as a gold star victim of rape. Like, I don't know.
And because you mentioned Cosby, the Gomeshi thing, I mean, these are things that happened in the last year. So, I mean, they didn't happen
mm-hmm.
in the last year, but, I mean, they certainly broke, these stories broke in the last year, and, mm-hmm. and they've resulted in, as you said, a change in the conversation. So does that change society if we're just talking about it? I mean, we've alluded to that already with, I mean, or is this part of the cycle that we're going to accept it, and then maybe 15 years from now we're going to have to talk about it again?
You know, that's a really good point. Probably it will be like that. We'll have this great moment where we're all talking about it, and then we feel like everything's fixed, and then no, we'll probably have to deal with this in another 10-15 years all over again. But I mean, if we just raise kids better now, we could change everything. Like, I feel yeah. like generational attitudes are shifting in a really, really big way. Even from when time I was a kid, like, so I do think there are some positive things, but yeah, I feel like we're probably going to have to keep talking about this for a really long time.
Yeah. And as a journalist, does that frustrate you that, say, attention is spent in one area of the conversation and then gets forgotten and then we have to go back to it? Or
Oh, for or? Sure. Like, the media has a pretty short cycle, and I even find myself now, it's like, oh, we talked about that a week ago. It's not news yeah. anymore. And I really lament the decline of journalism as a profession. There's a lot of benefit for long-form, well-researched journalism that you spend months or years pouring yourself into. That can be a game-changer, and I feel like we obviously don't have much of an attention span anymore.
Yeah.
We all feel that way, I think.
Yeah, no, we do.
Yeah.
In terms of journalism, why journalism for you?
I kind of fell into it backwards in college. I am actually a Canadian history major, and I really didn't do much with journalism. But, my college paper needed a sports editor, and I needed a job, and they let me do it, which was kind of fun. And then, yeah, the next year I just kept going with it. I really like editing. I like editing a lot more than I like writing stories, but I find I'm pretty curious about things, so
yeah.
if something seems strange, I want to know why that is.
You're not being patronizing, but you're a pretty good writer,
oh,
and so I assume that you'd always wanted to write.
It's not that I wanted to write, it's that I kind of have to write.
Yeah.
It's one of those things I can't get away from. I can put it down for a long time, but I always come back to it. And I mean, history prepped me pretty well for that. I was writing monster email or essays, that's what they called them back in the day.
Yeah.
And so I did a lot of academic writing, and yeah, I just working at the newspaper, it was a lot of fun. I worked there for 4.5 years and came to Vancouver and found myself at the Strait eventually.
Yeah, and what's it like working at the Strait?
It's fun, yeah. It's a challenge. I have a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the people, I mean, I follow you folks on Twitter. It mm-hmm. seems like a fun place to work.
It is, yeah. We have a lot of curious, bright people in the office.
Funny people, too.
Funny people, yes. Yes, it's very good to work with people with such a good sense of humor.
Yeah. What's Usinger like?
How you'd expect, yeah.
She's one of the funnier people.
That's
on
always
Twitter.
The first. That's always the question. It's like, what's Mike Usinger like? I'm like, how you expect? Yeah.
When people talk about the media in Vancouver, do you find yourself thinking that you're part of that milieu? I mean, because the Strait has had this long history of sort of alternative journalism, but it's become mainstream in the last, 20, 30 years or so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything tends towards the mainstream eventually.
So
like,
do you find that you folks at the Strait, especially, I hate to go back to the Furlong matter and the Laura Robinson piece, but the media, the other media, say, it really, you sort of saw where the media is, and as a consumer, it sort of confused me because I always thought of the Strait as a paper like anything else.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
But the other media, say, I don't know if they look down isn't the right word, but they sort of picked apart the work of the Strait a lot more than, say.
I don't think it was a lot more, though. I think they would have done it on any story. And I mean, like, you look at the Rolling Stone case, from University of Virginia. Like, they picked that apart. Like, and that was something. That's the Rolling Stone, right? Yeah. That's an institution. I think with a story as big as Furlong, you do need to scrutinize it, and I think the media was fair to do that. Mm-hmm. Like it would be irresponsible not to scrutinize the story.
Yeah.
But there's also the tendency with big stories to there's a lot of armchair quarterbacking, a lot of people are going to have opinions about things, and those opinions aren't necessarily I don't know the way to put
that. I guess it is competition then from say the broadsheet papers and the broadcast media when they pick apart the Strait or they look down on the Strait.
I don't think they should be looking down on us. No, the Strait's as legitimate journalism as anything going.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I see how hard the people in my office work, and I wouldn't consider myself a journalist necessarily. I write snarky blogs about transit and garbage. The people I work with they work hard. They know their stuff. They don't do things flippantly. It's been a great training ground. And,
Well, when people talk about stories like Evan Solomon, or they talk about, say, Brian Williams in the United States, and we're seeing a lot of stories like this in the media, do you think it's the media themselves that are concerned about it, or do you think regular people are, if you will?
That's a really good question. Honestly, I think that's the media obsessed with themselves to a certain degree.
So when we see a lot of attention on the Furlong case, do you think then that's just the media trying to navel gaze, say?
Maybe, but John Furlong wasn't a media personality like Brian Williams was, right? Like, Brian Williams was the face of a network and had certain authority to tell certain stories in a certain way, and when he's billed as a journalist, you are going to assume there's a certain level of propriety going on there, instead of lying about getting your helicopter shot down and lying about seeing bodies floating through the streets of New Orleans after Katrina. Like, when you are entrusted with that sort of authority, you best not abuse it.
And do you think these conversations about ethics, these are happening in every newsroom, aren't they? I mean, these are things that you folks, as practitioners of the craft, if you will, think about.
Absolutely. Well, I can't speak to other newsrooms, but the Strait, these are things that you think about all the time. And I would assume any responsible journalism or media outlet has a code of ethics that they keep to. And I mean, there's a way to be a responsible journalist, and there's a way not to be. And there's a way to be a responsible politician, and there's a way not to be.
I've always been interested as a media consumer, when I have people like you who work in the media, whether you think we're well served by the media that we have? And then just looking at how we, the landscape here in Vancouver, you work for The Straight, you know, all the broadcast outlets and the print, the other print outlets. Are there stories that we're not getting, say?
I think so. I think...
And whose fault is it, then?
It's ours, to a degree, but it's also the consumers, to a degree. I'm quite convinced most average citizens have no idea how journalism works. I think they think we decide on a story, we make up a story, we find some facts to slide into it, and then we present it as a hit piece. And I feel like... maybe because there is more public relations and, like, advertorial content and everybody's trying to sell you at something all the time, I feel like that's been also assigned to the media. And,
Well, what worries me is when I hear certain newspaper publishers in this country who say that, well, we're not paying enough for the news as it was media consumers, that it's our fault that, say, papers are folding or TV stations have to be, you know, cut. And I think that's a lot of blame to place on a citizen that you're supposed to be serving, say.
Oh, for sure. And, I mean, a lot of it is the industry. Like, I don't think the industry adapted to the times as much or as quickly as they could have or should have. With the rise of the internet, with everything being 24/7, you can get news about anything at any time. I don't think we value information like we used to. Like, you used to have to go to a book and read about a topic to understand the topic. Now you can read a dozen tweets, maybe a few hot takes, maybe a personal essay, maybe some news as well. And I don't know. I feel like it's a tough industry, and I'm not quite sure how to resolve that, because everything is driven by money, and when people don't want to pay for a product and advertisers don't see that they're getting any benefit, who's left to fund it, really? You can have a public broadcaster, but that's not getting funded either, and jobs are being lost. And I don't know. I feel the internet is a great tool in some ways, but it's definitely made it harder for people to make a living, because there's just so much information and there's so many people who are willing to do stuff for free just to get that, you know, those fake internet points, that dopamine hit, that little level of recognition. It's a weird tool. I have mixed feelings about the internet.
Let's talk about garbage, because that's something that you've written quite a great deal about. And I don't know if you noticed when you I don't know how you got here, but if you walk from Fraser in, I'm about halfway from Fraser, half a block in, there's a house there where, I don't know, he's got a composter or something like that, or he doesn't keep his garbage covered. Is that something that I could call the city about?
Yes, I do believe. Talk to 311.
Yeah.
I write about this a lot in my blog post now, because I've had really great experiences with 311.
Yeah.
Just give them a shout. They might, I mean, if it's within bylaws for the city, like if it's, then there's nothing they can do. But if it's causing, like, a quality of life issue, then I think you can probably contact the city.
Yeah, it's not terribly hot now. It hasn't been over 25. But, I mean, I can just see when it becomes 25-30.
Oh yeah, even walking, awful it'll be. Walking through my alleys on the days that they do the green bin collections, it's so gross, I can barely stand it. And it hasn't even been that hot yet, but it's just that rotted death smell, and like there's maggots everywhere, there's bottle flies, there's fruit flies. This is how we get rats, this is how we get roaches, and I hate that the city smells so bad.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy.
That's why we have to go do yoga on a bridge, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Right? We're always going up the gross grind to get away from the smell.
Yeah. Well, where I work, near Main and First, the dumpsters are just poorly kept.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk by them at night, like at 11, to get home.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, and as I said, it's not that hot. And
yeah.
when it gets hot, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah. I started the series when I was living near Commercial Drive, mm-hmm. and I'd get off the bus, and there'd be the overflowing garbage cans. And I took a walk through the alley one day, and it was hilarious how much garbage, like
yeah.
dumpsters full of garbage, furniture next to dumpsters, like more trash piled on top of that. And it just, it's this hot, wet, sticky,
yeah.
oppressive death smell.
And this happens not just at this time of year. I mean, there's dumping,
mm-hmm.
and that's illegal, of course.
Yeah.
Happening everywhere in the city.
Everywhere. All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. It gets really bad in December and April when students leave.
Yeah.
It's actually a really good time to go look for furniture out at the UBC dumpsters in April or May because there's tons of it.
Yeah.
Part of the problem, I think, with the dumping is that we don't have a large item pickup. City of Surrey, City of Burnaby,
mm-hmm.
quite a few of the outlying cities, they have large item pickup where the city will come and remove stuff like furniture free of charge.
Yeah.
But there's no program like that. Is it free of charge? I can't remember. You might have to pay a small fee. But
yeah, I'd expect you'd have to pay.
Yeah, Vancouver doesn't have anything like that. You have to rent a truck and take it down to the...
on Kent.
To the transfer depot, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd hate to work there. I mean, just the smell. There.
Yeah, it smells pretty bad there, but you get used to it real quick.
Transit is something that you also talk about a lot in your work. I guess we're sort of in this weird period where the ballots for the referendum have been turned in, and we're just waiting for the result. Is there a date on that?
There was. I can't remember what it was. I would have thought they would be counting the ballots as they came in,
yeah.
but that would be logical.
Too practical.
Right? Like, we have to have them all at the end. And, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's a non-binding plebiscite about whether or not to spend this money. And, like, the federal government just, dropped $8 billion in Toronto Transit? Hello, we need help over here. And, like, everybody's like, oh, but it's a world-class transit system. Twice this week, the 8 has skipped 3 buses, and I waited for half an hour for an every 10-minute bus. Like, that's not okay. Every morning, I'm watching pass-ups for the B line. It can't be that difficult to fix this transit system. But, yeah, we have 2 CEOs and no money, and it's just ridiculous.
Doesn't it fascinate you, though, I mean, how much we talk about transit? I mean,
mm-hmm.
and especially people that don't use transit talk about it.
Well, I mean, it's the same with cycling. I don't know how many people cycle. I imagine a lot more take transit, but we talk about bike lanes all the time. It's very strange. And it's just like, do you realize the more people you have on buses and on bikes is the fewer people in cars on the road and the easier your commute is?
Yeah.
Putting people on buses really is in the selfish car driver's best interest. And yeah, it's ridiculous.
I'm pretty archaic, so I look at everything through, say, the left versus the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, on the transit referendum, there's a lot of consensus on where it is. And it's not really left or right. It's more, I don't know, the politicians and where everyone else is.
I almost feel like that's a class war at
a
certain point. Vancouver doesn't have much of a middle class now. You're either extremely high income earnings, or there's the 90% of us here at the bottom who are just scraping out a living. I feel like there's a lot of people like me who are transit dependent. It's like, we need this to be functioning and better functioning than it is now. And when we watch the government waste all this money on the Compass card, when we were supposed to have fare gates activated 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and we're still waiting, and the system doesn't seem to work. Like, that's really frustrating, because you're like, why did you waste this money? Just put more buses on the road.
Exactly.
It seems so obvious to me, but not a transit planner, as much as I'd like to be one. So, yeah. I did try to get them to make me their CEO, but, yeah.
No?
I offered $75,000. That's all you have to pay me.
Yeah.
I won't even take a pension.
I asked you, the first question was about furlong, and we've talked about, say, transit now and garbage and real estate. I mean, it is about class, isn't it?
It is. I am.
And is it just because we're in Vancouver?
That I don't know. I've only ever lived here and Vancouver Island. I'm obviously of working class roots with...
I mean, the real estate thing that we've been confounded with in the last little while, I mean, that's class, right?
That's class. And it's also a bit of a generational divide. Yeah. I mean, you've got baby boomers who came up, had a job for 30 years, bought their piece of property in Kitsilano, and then they look at their kids, the millennials these days, and it's like, well, why can't you do what I did? Well, because there's no jobs that are going to give you 30 years worth of fair wages with health care, and there's no land left to buy. Like, we can't do what our parents did because those opportunities just aren't there. And when you have things like raising the retirement age, and then you have people keeping those jobs longer, there aren't jobs for us. Like, where do they think that we're going? It's really frustrating. It feels like, I kind of feel like I was sold this bill of goods as a kid. You know, you'll get to be an adult, you go to school, you'll get a job, you'll get a house. I was sold this idea that just doesn't exist. Like, it makes me so angry.
the future looks bleak, doesn't it?
It really does, and I feel like, maybe that's why we become so vitriolic online, because we just don't feel like there's much hope, you know? And it's really easy to dwell on the negative, especially when the negative stuff keeps getting worse and worse. Where's the bright spot? I'm not really sure.
And the other thing that fascinates me about you on Twitter, I can tell this from the avatar you have on Twitter, that you're a Mad Men fan.
I am. Oh my gosh, yes.
What do we do now?
I don't know. I've been watching Orphan Black, which is not analogous to Mad Men at all, but it's also really good storytelling. Yeah. It's a Canadian actress and a BBC American co-production. I have to find some new shows, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that was really, I mean, in the history of television, I mean, that's up there, isn't there? It's one of the greatest.
I think so. I mean, I haven't watched stuff like Breaking Bad or The Sopranos or even The Wire, which are the other three that usually get thrown out there. But Mad Men was really great storytelling, whether you agreed with what was going on or not. It was just beautifully done. What a vision for a show. And I'm so glad for Peggy. Everything worked out for her. It makes me so happy. Yeah, that stroll down the hallway like a boss.
Yeah. And you know what? Things worked out for Pete too, didn't they? Which was kind of sick, but...
Well, okay. So here's the thing about Pete. Yeah. He was such a little twerp, but... He was also, like, one of the more progressive characters. Like, there was a lot of things in his arc. Like, he was recognizing things about, like, African-American consumers before other people were realizing it. Mm-hmm. He had, like, this upper-class, waspy liberalism, in a way. And, I don't know, I have an appreciation for Pete. Even though he is kind of scummy guy. He grew.
Yeah, I guess folks of our generation, we think of, say, being a Republican as, say, whatever the Tea Party is today. But, I mean, the Republicans of the 60s, especially people like Pete, people like Cooper, even Roger to a certain extent, Don Draper especially, you know, I mean, his admiration for Nixon. Nixon is a guy who would not, as they say, get elected today.
Oh, no, but I can see... When you look back at, like, debates between Kennedy and Nixon, like, maybe not the televised debates, but the ones on radio, like, Nixon was very well-spoken. He had his policy down better than anybody else. He was not a stupid man.
And a lot more progressive than I think people give him credit for.
Well, I think so, yeah.
I mean, he's a neurotic man, and I guess that... that's how we remember him.
A little neurotic, a little paranoid. I think Nixon's greatest legacy is going to be as a head in a jar from Futurama. I think that's how people are going to remember him.
The character that I really liked on Mad Men was Ginsburg.
Oh my gosh.
And I wish Ginsburg. We saw him back, you know, we saw him come back, but I guess...
Well. I don't know how spoilery we want to be.
No, we
here,
can. I mean, it's people's fault for not watching it.
There you go. I think his arc was really... subtle, but I'm going to go back and rewatch just like the Ginsburg episodes. his mental illness was really, really well foreshadowed. Mm-hmm. Just the way that he talked and the things that, even how he dressed, mm-hmm. There was something off in his head, and Michael Weiner, he showed that, he laid it mm-hmm. all out. So like that scene with him and Peggy, that shouldn't have been a surprise.
Yeah, but and I talked to Kevin Chung about this when he was in mm-hmm. the scene where one of the first scenes where we meet him, and he's in the kitchen with his father, mm-hmm. or I don't know if that was his father, but the person that was with him, mm-hmm. who identified as his father, was just fascinating mm-hmm. in terms of, and I wanted to know what that was about. Mm-hmm. Even the silly things like those elevators that would open and there'd be no, mm-hmm. Elevator there, just a shaft.
Yeah.
I mean, I wondered what, and I was hoping that the last few episodes would address some of these things, but.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of it was just hallucinations in Don's brain trying to figure out how he's viewing the world in certain ways.
That's what alcohol does, I guess.
A little bit, like. Yeah, I feel like we got a lot of insight into Don and his weird dream sequences. Yeah. But if he hadn't had his dream sequences, we never would have seen Bert Cooper singing and dancing.
That wasn't that sweet.
That made me so happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I first watched it, I'm like, this is fascinating, I love this. And my second thought was, the internet is going to hate this. And they did. And I was so disappointed. But it was a really good cap, I think.
Yeah. And so what else? I mean, you mentioned Orphan Black. Is there anything else that can sort of fill this void? I mean, do you watch Veep? Do you watch Girls? Do you watch...
I watched the first couple of seasons of Girls. I'm kind of over that. I haven't watched Veep. It's come highly recommended. I actually got back into this old CBC series called Being Erica, which has... what's her name? Erin Karpluck in it.
Yeah.
And it's just really cute. I don't know. It's therapy and time travel, and that seemed to work for me. I don't know.
Yeah. This has been great fun for me. I so appreciate you coming in on a sunny Saturday to do this.
Thanks so much for having me.
The websites for more, farmhousepress.wordpress.com, and of course, straight.com. The Georgia Straits, Miranda Nelson, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantov.